Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
And the award for best newcomer goes to, yes, my baby boy, Dirk Diggler!
Woo! The award goes to... Here we go again, Dirk Diggler.
Award for Best Actor goes to... I've seen all his movies and I can't wait to work with him. Mr. Dirk Diggler!
Wow. I don't know what to say. I guess... Well, I guess the only thing I can say is I'll promise to keep rocking and rolling and making better films. Yeah. You know, it seems you make these movies, and sometimes, you know, they're considered filthy or something by some people. But I don't think that's true. These movies we make, they can be better. They can help. They really can. I mean that. We can always do better. I'm going to keep trying if you guys keep trying. Let's keep rocking and rolling, man.
What makes a man? Is it the power in his hands? Isn't his quest for glory? Give it all you got to fight to the top, so we can know your story. Man, is it the woman in his arms? Just cause she has big titties? Or is it the way he fights every day? No, it's probably the titties. Now you're a man.
Start posting that online and just, you know, but make it sort of a bounty thing where you just sort of up the ante. It is, oh, Trey Parker, to feel your soft, loving caresses, I would do anything. And then begin listing the things you would do specifically.
I tried doing that with Alan Rickman and it ended poorly.
You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It is 31 minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of April in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not very ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network.
looming high above the milkpacking district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us and making a part of your listening day. Welcome to Day 12, ladies and gentlefolk. It is April 1st, 2011. If you'd like to engage with us telephonically today, you can do that. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. That's how you do that. You can also email if you like. It's rick at rickemerson.com. That is rick at rickemerson.com. You can email Dawn Taylor if you like. It's Dawn, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Text box on the website open. And also you can Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show via Skype. That's our username there. Rick Emerson Show. Coming up later on the day, we got your Taser Watch, Penis Watch, Corpse Watch, basically all the things that we laid out yesterday before Anna Griffin got to the studio. And then we, by the way, I think
got to him.
But I think I can note just for the record, and I think probably the House will be with me on this, I think we have passed any sort of event horizon beyond which we need to be concerned about what Anna Griffin thinks of the content of our stories. Since I was sort of keeping a mental tally yesterday, and I would say that probably a good 35 or 40% of the socially inappropriate things that were uttered in the studio came from her. So many of those having to do with things of a quasi blue nature. So
I think it's like Ron the sports guy over at KPAM getting the opportunity to talk about the Bee Gees.
Exactly.
I think Anna Griffin writes for the Oregonian. She probably bottles up a lot of what would be considered inappropriate, non-family friendly things, throughout her day. And then she gets to come here and just say whatever she damn well pleases.
So I think we've pole vaulted over the line of social propriety with her. I wouldn't worry about us. I think we need to self-censor going forward. But we didn't get to anything yesterday just because, we were just,
She works in the same building as Peter Carlin. I mean, come on.
And that's got to infect you at some point. However much one might try to shield oneself, that's probably a losing game. So we were just too busy playing Almost Paradise and Kenny Rogers songs yesterday. So we'll get to the Corpse Watch, the Taser Watch, Penis Watch today. Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio just a little while from now. Just a fur piece from here to there is Mr. Big Jim Willig. He'll be in the studio with another installment of Humor Comedy 101 today, talking about Mr. Andy Kaufman. Let's see what else is coming up. Dawn Taylor's tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
We still have some discussion about the TriMet driver who was punched in the face the other day.
Oh, we'll get that sound ready.
We do. And also, there are 15 cocktail waitresses out of a job in Atlantic City because apparently they didn't look good in the new uniforms. And a man in Nebraska who is making a mountain in his yard out of recyclable materials.
Okay. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. That's what's on the agenda. My friends, my pals, my chums. That's all coming up today. Plus, a variety of things and stuff and whatnot. All right. This is where I would talk about what I did last night, but I don't know that I even remember what I did last night. It seems like I should. I was there and everything.
Yeah.
Ooh, I know what I did last night.
Okay.
It's not really that exciting.
Did you watch Justified?
No, I did. Oh, yes, I did. No, I did. I did watch Justified. I thought you were going to ask if I fell back into watching The West Wing, and I did not. I did. Not like my life is all that interesting most of the time. Like, I just, it's not like I'm sort of jet-setting around the world, and just engaging in high-flying shenanigans of the most exotic variety. That's just not what I do. Last night, here was the big highlight of my evening last night, is that I had to go to, I had an appointment on, way up on Division or something. And so on the way back from Division to my home, this was really the peak of my entire day. This is just as exciting as my life gets. I had to drive up to 85th and Division. So as I'm driving up 85th and Division, which is always just a big chore because, it's like rush hour traffic and, you're just behind every backward-ass moron on the planet. And I'm always behind people from Idaho who can't drive to save their goddamn lives. So I'm just sitting there and it's, the sun is beating down and I'm just sitting in my car and I'm just feeling, fatigued and just sort of staring at the window and whatever. But on my way to the appointment in the Division, I passed a Dairy Queen. And it was that thing of just making an instant decision that, on the way back, I am just going to go through the Dairy Queen drive-in and I'm going to order whatever it is that I feel like ordering, and I'm not going to worry about eating well. I'm not going to worry about I'm just going to have none of the normal neuroses that would prevent me from doing that. So the highlight of my day was I went to my appointment on the way back, stopped by the Dairy Queen. I went through, and by the way, can I just say a little FYI to the DQ? At some point, they got rid of the Snickers Blizzard, which is, of course, the best of all the Blizzard flavors.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if you have a particular fondness or a favorite in terms of the... Because that's another thing I get very often. Like, you know, ice cream and, you know, like sweets and I don't, you know, except for cookies, don't really get along all that well. But every now and again, it's a thing that I just want. So anyway, so I'm sitting at the drive-thru and it's that whole business of where I'm at the drive-thru and I say, I'll have a Snickers Blizzard. And the woman says, I'm sorry, we don't have that anymore. And then you get to do that sort of quick triage because you don't want to be the person just sitting there at the drive-thru holding up the entire line because then they hate you inside and then you worry what's going into your food and the people behind you hate you. And then the longer you wait there, the more likely it is that you're just going to reconsider and you're just going to say, well, F this. I'm just going to go home and have a bag of lettuce or something. So I ended up getting like the Heath Bar Blizzard or something, which here's another thing about that. It's not like I didn't enjoy it because I did, but isn't it understood that when you're getting a Blizzard or any sort of an ice cream that has like stuff in it, that has crap just sort of mashed up and put into it, you can't crush that stuff too finely or otherwise it just defeats the entire purpose.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean, the whole point of the Blizzard is to have some sort of a chunk quotient in there. And it just, you know, and they just went berserk with the ball peen hammer on this. So it was like, so that part of it was unsatisfying. But I got I got the whole, you know, sort of the sort of bacon cheeseburger thing going on. But then I got a Blizzard, and the highlight of my day, I just went home and I watched Justified while just shoveling huge, huge ladlefuls of ice cream and crushed up Heath Bar into my mouth.
Oh.
And I ate the entire thing in one sitting, and then I swear to God, I sat there. I didn't put down my clothes. I didn't feed the dog. I didn't do anything. I didn't, I didn't put on my typing boots, any of my morning, any of my afternoon rituals. I just walked into the house. I sat down in the chair, literally walked into one fluid motion, walked right by Max while holding a cheeseburger and a large Blizzard, which is a thing that he's probably still irritated about. Walked into the office, shut the door, got out my laptop, threw it open, sat down, watched Justified, and just shoved an entire thing of ice cream and cheeseburger into my mouth. And then at the end, something I don't do very often, I just leaned back and I just belched. And then I just sat there for about half an hour and just stared at a wall. And that, I gotta tell you, however dull this may make me sound, that was really just one of the best parts of the entire week for me. It was really just a glorious 25 minutes. And then I just, I don't know, then I did whatever else it was my evening.
I'm deeply grateful that I don't live anywhere in the vicinity of, like, a readily available Dairy Queen. Because I used to drive past one every single day on my way home from work when I worked at the newspaper in St. Helens. Because there's one out on the highway there in Scappoose or something. And I'd drive by it every single day. And I'd be really, really tired and my blood sugar's low and all fatigued. And you know, you have that thing, too, sometimes when you're just really tired and you've worked really hard. And particularly if you have a job you hate just a lot, where you feel like, I deserve something just for me.
I owe this to myself.
Of course, when you do that every day, you're just a pig. But and so I would have to just go, no Dairy Queen today, because they sell this amazing thing called the Moulatte. And the Moulatte was there trying to cash in on the Frappuccino deal. Well, the thing with the Moulatte is it's like a Frappuccino with soft serve ice cream in it.
That sounds fantastic.
And like coffee syrup.
Like a float?
No, it's a blended beverage.
It's like a milkshake almost.
It's kind of like a milkshake, but it's like the it's got like slushy ice. I watched them make it through the window once. They actually have a whole thing that does slushy ice for the they have some kind of a slushy ice slurpy kind of a drink that I can't remember what it's called.
The Mr. Misty.
Yeah. So they use that, the unflavored that. And then they glorp a whole bunch of vanilla soft serve ice cream into it. Then they put a whole bunch of like this hardcore extreme coffee syrup in there. Then if you get the mocha one, they also put like chocolate syrup in it. Blend the whole thing together. And first of all, it's awesome. It probably is at like about 3,000 calories, but it's just awesome. Not only is it way better than any Frappuccino, because in addition to the little crispy, crunchy ice bits that make it kind of a blended ice drink, it also actually has real ice cream in it. And between the coffee syrup and the chocolate syrup, it ends up being more chocolatey flavored than their milkshakes. Because that's the big problem with the Dairy Queen milkshakes is if you get a chocolate shake or they never seem to be like really taste chocolatey.
No, it's like vanilla with a hint of chocolate.
Yeah, but the Moulatte on the other, and they have you can get like just the coffee flavored one, the mocha, this coffee thing, and then they have a caramel one that they actually add the caramel topping from the ice cream.
Wow.
And some of it like kind of sticks to the sides of the thing and sinks down the bottom, so you end up with these chunks of like solidifying caramel in the thing. It's the best thing ever.
That's fantastic. That sounds really good.
And yeah, and then so, but the problem is, I drove by Dairy Queen
every day
while I was working at a job that I had to stay at for like way too many hours, and just hated my life every day. So I was probably drinking a Moo Latte like 3 times a week, and that's not good for you. That's just a big white fist around your heart,
drowning your sorrows in glucose. And
yeah.
And that's the thing where you do. You have that moment of just of hesitation, like yesterday. So I go to the drive-thru, and I ordered the double cheeseburger, and I said I'll have a double cheeseburger, and I will have a. And the thing is, the sizing on everything has gone crazy, but the sizing on the Blizzards is weird too, because the small is actually not that small. I mean, the smallest, especially because the thing is, when you look at the Blizzard and you say, you know, you order a small Blizzard, people think of it like you're ordering a small drink. Yeah. You're not ordering a small drink. I mean, you're ordering ice cream.
Yeah.
And so the idea that they're giving you a beverage glass full of ice cream that also has candy bars mashed up and shoved into it. I mean, that's...
If you get a 16-ounce one, which is, I think, the medium, that's a pint.
Yeah.
That's a pint of ice cream.
Yeah. How much do you really need? That's my thing. And so, you know, they've introduced the mini now, I think, because people have started complaining about, like, you know, how much of this, like, you know, can I possibly ingest?
What do you people want from me?
My body just gives up. But I order the bacon, or it wasn't even with bacon, it was just a double cheeseburger. Because bacon, that would just make me a glutton.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to say that ended up actually, I can't remember the last time that I had a, and I should know better by now, I can't remember the last time I had a drive-thru, you know, a sort of fast food cheeseburger, leaving aside like In-N-Out or whatever. I can't remember the last time I had a drive-thru fast food hamburger that I actually enjoyed, that I ate and I went, that was exactly what I wanted, that hit the spot. I should know better than to try by now because they're never that good.
The high-end burgers at some of the places like Burger King and even McDonald's now, if you go for like their Angus burger,
yeah.
But the more expensive burgers at places like Carl's Jr. are actually not bad. They're pretty good. But like you saw me the other day when I came in and I had my Mike's Drive-In
or Mike's
burger, and it was like with the sautéed mushrooms and onions and Swiss cheese, and I bit into that and I just made one of those like weird orgasm faces where I was just sitting there and I just went, ugh. I made some Homer Simpson noise when I first bit into it because it was like real hamburger.
Well, now, is that a thing where do they over condiment that burger?
Not really, no.
Because that was the thing at Dairy Queen, too, where it's like they just, you know, I should have known I was in trouble and they didn't even really ask what I wanted. And so I got it and it was just... and it's just, you know, it's...
That's why I hate Burger King, because it's like, all of a sudden there's all this, like, mayonnaise
and
crap on it.
And it was actually so bad. There were so many... And here's the other thing, is that, like, I get to, you know, I'm at the Dairy Queen, which is on, like, 60th and Division. I mean, it's, you know, it's not too far from my house. So I get the stuff, and of course, I'm listening to an audiobook. I'm listening to Bill Bryson talk about hiking the Appalachian Trail, and he's talking about just eating a handful of nuts, you know, and just taking, you know, and with us we took a packet of noodles, a handful of nuts, and raisins. One needs to eat well on the trail. And I'm going, that's really fascinating. I love the story about him hiking the Appalachian Trail and then climbing mountains in New Hampshire. And he's talking about how at the end of a summer of climbing all the peaks in New Hampshire, he'd lost like 35 pounds, and, you know, and he was rippling with sinew and muscle and, you know, the joy of being alive and exercising. And meanwhile, I'm just spooning. And of course, I couldn't even wait to get home because that's not what you do. I'm driving. I shouldn't even be admitting this. So they hand me the bag of stuff through the window. And I should be unnerved by the fact that it was like ready 5 seconds after I ordered it. You know, I'll have a double cheeseburger and a Blizzard. And by the time I got my money out and handed them the 20 or whatever, it's like they were handing it back to me. And that indicates something bad about the food, that it's just there ready to be handed to me. So So they hand me the Blizzard, and of course the Blizzard is, you know, it's so full that like the lid barely can fit on. So, well, just take the lid off. And so I'm now, and then I get to the point where I'm on like, what, 39th, and I'm steering with my knees. I mean, I'm doing all the wrong things. I'm steering with my knees while adjusting my iPhone, you know, volume, you know, with my finger or something so I can hear the sound of the Bill Bryson audiobook, the Bill Bryson audiobook, over the sound inside my head of the Blizzard being slurped and swallowed as I'm spooning it. I mean, right there, that's like 5 hands that I need. And then also, yeah, I'm driving a car and it's in rush hour. So if anybody saw me yesterday, what you saw was a guy going by, steering the car with his knees while ladling Blizzard into his mouth and then occasionally picking up an iPhone to adjust the volume level of the hiking book he was listening to. So it was just retarded on every level. So I finally got home. Yeah, I got inside, and I just, you know, I went right to the office and just sat there and just shoved the rest. The hamburger was actually, there were so many condiments on there, actually I had to put it in the toaster oven and toast the bun to where I could get it to where it wasn't just, you know, to where it wasn't just semi-liquefied. But, so that's
one of the great Mike's Drive-In things, too, is because they cook your burger, first of all, on a grill, the old-fashioned kind of grill, and then they put the bun on the grill. So you get that toasty bun layer. So you get a little bit of, you know, when you're biting through.
See, that's the good stuff right there. That's faster. So anyway, so that was... And really, honestly, I don't remember anything else about my night last night. That was it. That was after that, it's all just I did watch Justified. We can talk about that in just a bit. That was watch Justified last night, which was great. And then at some point I went to bed, and that was it. And then I woke up this morning to the sound of my wife watching an Army Wives marathon in the other room. So that's just the kind of living on the edge environment that is at Shea Emerson. How was your evening, Don?
Oh, it was just about as exciting. I ended up I've got Mormon Book Club tonight, and so our theme, which kind of ties into a scene or two in the book that we're reading, our theme is foods that you would eat at a summer barbecue.
What are you currently reading?
The book was called A Friend of the Family. Mm. I mentioned that it's the kind of book Laura might like, because it's about
white
people having upper middle class tragedies. And so... Yeah, so the theme was food you would eat at a summer barbecue. And so I made, and Patrick was really tired and wasn't feeling very well, and he deserved some kind of food. So I ended up making this huge, monstrous amount of orzo pasta with feta cheese and shrimp and diced up, like, tomatoes and cucumbers and things in it, and fresh dill and stuff, which was quite delicious. But between washing all those dishes and, like, cleaning up the kitchen so that I could cook, then making that stuff, then cleaning up afterwards, then I started looking around going, oh, God, I'm supposed to make cookies for Big Ass Sandwich. And then I just kind of lost it at that point and went, no, that's it. That's all
happen.
I could do. I made food. I ate food. Here's something, though. I watched Grey's Anatomy, which I don't know why.
Why? Are you a watcher of that show on a regular basis?
I am, and I myself am at a loss to explain why.
Did you? No, because I was actually just thinking about this the other day, because I saw, you know, tonight on an all-new Grey's Anatomy, and I actually had that moment of, like, that's still on? Because it's in its seventh season or something now, and I bailed out after, I think, season two or three.
I watch it for the same reason I think that people watch soap operas, you know? It's like, I started watching it the first season... And I kept watching it, and the show kind of sucks most of the time, but I keep watching it. I can't stop watching it at this point, because even though I say I'm not going to watch it anymore, I keep coming back because I keep just wanting to know, you know, I got to catch up with my stories.
Is it just a force of the force of habit at this point? Like, you would just feel like it was like your life was missing a puzzle piece?
It's a completion thing. It's like, you know, there's a new Grey's Anatomy, and then I think, oh, I can't watch it. And I was like, I have to. I don't know why. It's a compulsion, because I really don't care. But I watched it last night, and they did the thing. This is the new thing. We can all blame Joss Whedon, and once more with feeling. Apparently, every TV show now has to have an episode where people sing.
Right.
And, to make them sing, there has to be, like, and these are like hospital shows now, because Scrubs did it, House did it to some degree, now Grey's Anatomy did it, and there always has to be some character who has some kind of, like, brain injury so that they imagine people are singing.
Or that where, he's got a strange neuro-linguistic problem where he can't understand things that are just delivered in a monotone, so everything has to have a melody for his brain to actually hear the language. I guess we'll have to sing the rest of the dialogue.
And they do have a number of actors on Grey's Anatomy who are very good singers. The basic reason for it, though, seemed to be that for several seasons now, and it's my one of the reasons I really watch it, is my favorite actress on the show is an actress named Sarah Ramirez, and she plays this character named Callie. And one thing I like about her, she's not skinny. She's actually got some meat on her bones. Other thing is, she's just kind of awesome, and she came to them from Broadway. She was in Spamalot, of all things, and she's done a lot of musical theater. And I guess somebody said, you know, we need to come up with a reason for her to sing, because she's awesome.
Right.
And so they did this thing where she's like very pregnant, and she and her lesbian lover and the doctor who knocked her up, who's her best friend, and the three of them are going to raise the child together. So anyway, they have that typical thing of like, yay, we're going to be happy and everything's going to be awesome. And we're going to go away for the weekend and share a lot. Oh, car accident. Right. Oh, she might lose the baby. She's unconscious, but she's fantasizing that everyone's singing. Right. So, which was idiotic, but they kept having her sing. And she's amazing. So it was just this combination of things where the show itself, really stupid. The device they used for this, really stupid. Some of the song choices, painful. Like when she's in the operating room and everyone's singing How to Save a Life. So, but at the end, what was it? The song was, I can't remember who records it, but the song.
Are these covers? They're all covered.
But the end, the very end, she's like trying, I think, to will her body back into consciousness or something. And she sings a song, I Was Made for You.
Right, yeah.
And she's amazing. And it's a song that I don't even really like very much, but her rendition of it was just so like, chills up your spine good.
You can also blame Glee for this. This is not just Once More with Feeling. This is, especially that's why I asked if they were covers, because that's where you suspect that some meeting happened in a boardroom somewhere where there was some revenue stream to be had from a record company or from the record company that is affiliated with the network because they're owned by the same international oligarchy. And so they just said, look, we'd like you to perform these. It's like when Mr. White says to Guy Patterson, you record these songs from the Playtone catalog. That's totally what this is, what the guy says. Here's a bunch of artists that are on labels owned by the same company that employs everybody at Grey's Anatomy. Please to pick five of them and then put them in your show.
But I kind of enjoyed it and kind of hated it all at the same time. And plus, this is the thing about Grey's Anatomy, one of the things that really drives me crazy, too. Her character is named Callie Torres. Her given name is Calliope. Her lover is named Arizona. So it's Calliope and Arizona.
Okay.
It's bad enough that you have more than one character with some kind of cutesy names, but then you have them in a relationship together. Her lesbian lover, played, by the way, by Jessica Capshaw, Kate Capshaw's daughter, who is a considerably, but just going by Grey's Anatomy, eons better of an actress than her mom.
That's hard to imagine. You suspect with episodes like that it's where when somebody sings, like I think about this on the, I thought about this on the house the other day, when there was, in fact, there was this episode, you were just talking about something like this episode of House where the guy couldn't, I don't know, it's like the guy couldn't hear something, but the guy had to sing something, but it ended up with House like coming in and like holding a guitar and like playing a song to the guy. And then there was that thing where, there was that episode where House Dave Matthews.
Oh,
where Dave Matthews was the gifted piano patient who was also like a retard or something. And so he and House were, I don't know, he and House, and there was that sequence where he and House had a duet. They do like an ebony and ivory thing, you know, like on the piano where they're like, their hands are like, you know, interlacing as they're doing both halves of the song together. And you suspect that it's just that the actor is just like obsessed with the rest of America knowing how multi-talented he is. And so he insists at some point that they write, like it must be in their contract, that they must write a musical episode. Because it's that old thing about like all comedians want to be rock stars and all rock stars want to be comedians. That's why comedians inevitably will schlep some guitar onto stage and they'll sing at you for the same reason that all rock stars end up, you know, being in some sort of a terrible film, with Chris Farley or something at some point. You know, well, you turn on this, like, what's with this? Well, it's Chris Rock and Joe Perry from Aerosmith. And so I think actors must at some point decide that it's not enough that everybody watch them on television, that they, you know, 50 million people watching them on a series every week. Everybody has to know how, you know, the multifaceted their gifts are.
What especially interesting is that Patrick Dempsey, who I assume can sing, I believe I've seen him sing before. I know that I've seen him dance in things. He's an extraordinary dancer. He made that one movie where he was like the teenage gigolo guy who was dating like Kirstie Alley and all of the ladies in there, and he was dancing. He's an amazing dancer, and I swear to God, I've seen him in something, and he didn't sing a word in the whole show. And I just wonder if he just looked at the script and just went, no,
I'm not going to do this.
No, but come on, it's like no.
There was this great moment of revelation this morning, actually, as I was sort of puttering around the house as I do, and So I had, you know, Lars out there watching this, you know, Army Wives show, which is in like its 90th season or something.
I watched the first, I think, three seasons of that and then didn't have Lifetime anymore. And so I didn't bother to.
So it's funny that you say that because this morning she actually, she added, I think, rather unnecessarily. She said, "Baby, it's a very special episode of Army Wives." And I said, is it now? Because, of course, there was some guy who was, like, you know, killed saving his friend's life, like in, you know, Kyrgyzstan or something. And the thing about it is, like, every episode of Army Wives is a very special episode. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the whole. But you know what she discovered but did not? She had not known but realized this morning while she was watching. She let it play all the way to the end of the episode. And, that you know, and they did sort of a, if you've enjoyed Army Wives, you might also like. And I walked back out into the living room as I was getting ready to leave, and she said, "Oh my God, this is a Lifetime show." And I said, "Well, yeah, of course it is. What network did you?" Because she's watching it on DVD.
Oh.
And I said, "What network did you think, you know, carried Army Wives?" And she said, "I don't know, but I didn't think it was." And then, like 10 seconds later, she said, "Because the other show that she's mainlining right now is." My wife is watching two shows, right? Three shows, actually, because now Top Chef is done for the season. So we watched the finale of Top Chef last night because she didn't know that Richard Blaise won. So we watched the finale of Top Chef. But now the two shows she's watching that is finished, she's watching Army Wives, and she's watching. I don't even like to say this out. I have to tell you, my wife's a very intelligent woman.
She is.
She's very smart, she's, you know, smarter than I am, has multiple degrees and things. I say all this because the other show that she's watching is Drop Dead Diva.
Oh.
Yeah, I know.
Oh.
Which is also a Lifetime show.
Yeah.
And she's watching that on DVD as well. Mm-hmm. And she had no idea. And so there was, and just as I left this morning, she hadn't actually sorted it out within her own soul. As I walked out the front door, she was still sitting on the couch trying to wrestle with the realization that the shows that she loves, these two programs, are both on Lifetime, which I think she had at some point in her life decided she was better than. And then without realizing it, she began watching a lot of their programming. And so she's apparently having to come to terms with that, you know, today.
Yeah, that happens. You know, the thing is, she is very, very intelligent. And she deals with weighty, actually important things during her work day.
Let's not try to give her an excuse.
No, but it is an excuse, though, because I think that, you know, if people, I am far more willing to cut someone slack for watching just junk food TV or reading junk food books if they're. They spend hours and hours a day actually dealing with things that are useful and valuable and take real knowledge and real brain power and real talent. You get your downtime. You get your time to just go, and now I get to relax. It's like a nice, you know, hot, warm jacuzzi for your brain where you're just like, this isn't going to make me work. It's just going to entertain me, and I because their brain is working all the time. It's the people who are just stupid and do stupid things that don't take any brain power, and then they go home and just watch stupid things. Those people I have no respect for at all. Them, I just think are they're just losers.
Just they are fused to a chair.
They're just useless, and they're just dragging the rest of it down.
Excellent. On that note, let's go to the news desk, ladies and gentlemen. Here's Dawn
and
Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Right side, which of these to do? Here we go. 15 servers are out of a job at the Resorts Casino in Atlantic City, and they say it's discrimination. Catherine Felici worked as a cocktail server at the casino since it opened on Memorial Day weekend in 1978. And though she appears fit, she apparently was not fit enough to wear the new costume set to be unveiled this Memorial Day weekend.
She started working there in 1978.
Right.
So that's she's 30. So that's 32 years ago.
Right.
So she's probably 50.
In her 50s, yeah.
Okay, all right.
She said, "I was brought up to the office and told I did not meet the requirements for the uniform and was let go." New owners took over Resorts in December and are moving to a Roaring Twenties theme, dovetailing off the cable TV series Boardwalk Empire, set in Prohibition-era Atlantic City. The new costumes are a revealing flapper girl style. You can actually look this up online. You can Google Resorts Casino cocktail uniforms and see the picture. The fired worker said they were told to try them on and photos were taken of them to see how they look in them. One of the fired cocktail servers said, "We thought they were taking these pictures to critique the uniform and to try to get it to something that would look good on everybody." And that wasn't the case.
Well, there is no uniform that looks good on everybody, first of all.
No. Turned out they were taking pictures of them so they could look at them and go, oh, she's got to go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but when you said she's a server, she's a cocktail waitress, is that the thing?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there is an expiration date for being a cocktail waitress,
I think.
That is a thing that does – that's like being a candy striper. At a certain point, you're just – it's not going to work.
Yeah, the big problem, though, is that in the case of this particular casino, the cocktail waitresses belong to a union.
Oh.
And so the union is saying, hey, age discrimination, because 40 new servers have been hired and almost all of them are in their 20s.
It seems like that's one of those things where if you wonder what the job is described as being, because that's probably where it all gets resolved. Like if the contract says like, and you must be aesthetically appealing, that's one thing. Otherwise, it's just, you know, that's just that ends up being just a massive payout that they've got to do to everybody. I do wonder about that, though. I mean, if there's jobs where you have to interact with the public and you must be, you know, you have to have a pleasing and presentable appearance, and how that gets defined. I will tell you that having gone to at the El Cortez, which is, the casino that we were talking about the other day, you go there and there is obviously some sort of a. It's like with venues for performers where it's like, you know, you peak and you're playing, you know, like, you know, the Madison Square Garden or the Forum or the Rose Garden. And then later it's like you're at the Roseland. And then later you're just like playing like, you know, in some guy's living room. And then later you're just sort of, you know, later you're just putting up a series of badly recorded YouTube videos of yourself. And there is the same thing with cocktail waitresses in Vegas where they all end up.
And strippers.
Yes, absolutely. And they just end up, you know, at the El Cortez and just sitting there. And they've still got like the deep dish cleavage thing going on. But it's like they're 150 years old.
Can I freshen that up for you, hon?
Exactly. Hey, sweetie, you want some? You want some nachos or anything? And it's like, and they're just bending over, and they're giving you and they're doing all the moves that like they did just like muscle memory when they were like, you know, when they were 20. But meanwhile they're 94 years old and they're smoking through a hole in their throat. While going, hey, can I? You know anything? Do you want any more? Do you want any more for your food or anything? And it's like you're looking.
You stick around for another half hour. The appetizer's a half price.
And you look over and you go, no, I don't. Oh, never mind. And you're just back on the felt. So yeah, that's all right. Here's Don Taylor.
A TriMet bus driver said he was assaulted and punched in the face Tuesday while behind the wheel. The driver, whose name is not being released, said he was on break during a spot on Swan Island at 2:45 in the afternoon. The accused, Katrina Engblom, 25, got angry when the driver asked her for bus fare. She cursed at him, jumped off the bus, pulled on the windshield wipers, went to the driver's side and punched him twice in the face. Another bus driver for TriMet said, it's not that surprising. These kinds of things happen every day, which leads to the continuation of his quote, which he also said this.
I've been threatened. I've had individuals threaten to put fishing poles in my eye, bodily harm, tempted to be spat upon.
Fishing poles in his eye.
I had individuals threatened to put fishing poles in my eye.
Maybe my understanding of physics is different than that of some, but I don't know that that's actually possible. That's just a threat, I think.
I love the way he just says that, though, as if it's happened multiple times. Like, this is a regular occurrence.
Like, it's a common
threat.
People
threatening to put fishing poles in his eye.
I'd like to know exactly what form that threat took and exactly how it was phrased, you know? I mean, why people go right to the fishing pole? Let me just...
I've been threatened. I've had individuals threaten to put fishing poles in my eye, bodily harm, tempted to be spat upon.
What part of the fishing pole do you imagine? Is it the end? Is it the handle? How do you do that?
Were they on the bus with the fishing pole, or was it just they thought, I have fishing poles at home and I will come back with them?
I mean, you're not allowed to just, you can't, the bus doesn't go to the, it doesn't stop at the creek, I don't think. And so I don't know why, it's not like you're just going to be on there laden down with tackle and trout or whatever.
I think that's my go-to threat now from whenever I will just say to someone when I'm angry, I will put fishing poles in your eye.
Jesus. Oh, by the way, somebody just says, worst blizzard flavor ever. I didn't even know this existed. Worst blizzard flavor ever, the short-lived black licorice blizzard.
Oh!
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I had a friend, though, who was quite the blizzard aficionado, and I was not aware of the fact that you can actually get them to flavor the ice cream. And so there, you can get all kinds of crazy, you know, combinations.
What do you mean flavor the ice cream?
I mean, they have all the different flavors they use for ice creams and drinks and stuff like that. So you can get, like, a mint...
Strawberry ice cream with Snickers or whatever.
Yes, like getting a strawberry blizzard with like say crunched up Oreo cookies in it. You get like the strawberry and the chocolate cookie thing. Very good. Yeah, a mint chocolate one, because you, and then it's a green mint blizzard with the chocolate. You know, and so once I discovered that, it was like, well, sky's the limit.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Apparently they make a blizzard out of, see, this is a thing that I wouldn't necessarily want, but apparently they make a blizzard out of Nerds candy as well. Which seems
that
like
I would not like. They're already weird and hard.
It's a little
hard.
Too much there.
I don't like hard little things in my ice cream.
No.
I like some things with some texture, but if it, like, I think it's what's Ben and Jerry's fish food.
Yeah.
And the little chocolate fish are too hard.
Yeah.
And so you're like, ice cream, God, now I have to chew through something. No, that just annoys me.
There's an ice cream that's called Moose Tracks that is similar to fish food.
Yeah.
And again, it depends on the mood I'm in. But here's the thing about the Snickers Blizzard, and this is why I was really upset they didn't have it. The Snickers Blizzard is the great combination of hard, because you get the sort of the chocolate exterior that then becomes solidified. You know, it becomes even harder by dint of being in the ice cream. But then it's got the chewiness in the center of it. And that really is, I mean, that's a pleasing, and the creaminess of the ice cream. That's a pleasing texture to one's mouth. So that's really, what I was. And it's not like I didn't eat the entire thing. I did. And it was really, as I think I noted, I couldn't even really wait to get home. I was just steering with my knees while just doing, and I'm doing that. And that's only because it was too embarrassing to just go and be slurping ice cream off the top like I was some sort of a fleshy Hoover. But that's that thing where you've had the specific item in mind for, you know, like an hour or most of the day, and then you get there and it's like that's the one thing they're out of, and then you're having to decide what else to what else to put in there. So, you know,
I have learned the whole thing of not combining the things I'm craving in one order, though, because that was my mistake often with the Dairy Queen, is that I'd be like, ooh, a moo latte, had a bad day, I'm going to want my moo latte, and they have onion rings. I will also get onion rings. And the thing is, getting like the stomach full of the ice cream product plus the greasy fried onion rings, I would just feel so terrible later that I just want to die.
Well, that's
like, why did I do that?
That must suck for your stomach too, because it's like, you know, where your stomach looks at me and goes, oh God, here comes, you know, onion rings. All right, okay. You know, and it's like, and you're just hitting your body with just grease and just fat and lard and salt.
And here's the sugar and the caffeine too. Don't forget that.
And as the onion rings are being processed, right, it goes, okay, it looks like we've weathered the, oh God, no. You know, and you just, as the blizzard is coming down, your body's going, really? Honestly, are you saddling me with, okay? And sometimes I do this. This is a result, I think, of too many years of classroom films where they try to explain things by use of clever animated, anthropomorphized and animated objects or items, such as, you know, like animals or tires or like, you know, George Washington, the dollar bill, walking around telling you about how to save money or something. So as a result, I sometimes view my heart as just this guy who, you know, sort of a heart-shaped guy with big, googly, friendly eyes. And every now and again, like when I'm eating really, really badly, or if I'm just abusing my body in some way, I will just picture him doing these sort of doing a sort of horizontal pushing out of his arms, like he's doing sideways push-ups, and just kind of going, just trying to pump while I'm just filling my bloodstream with fat and just basically doing everything but filling my veins with grout. And he's just going, okay, I'm doing the best I do. And then it's always while I'm climbing some stairs and I get really winded. And finally, I just picture him just going, nah, I'm taking some time off. And then that's when I have a thrombosis and pass out.
Patrick is having that experience now because the whole time I've known him for, you know, 12 years now, 13 years. And he has always been one of those fellows who's like, I'm going to live forever. I will just always continue to eat the way I did when I was 16 years old. I could live on fried chicken if I had to. And now he's had his gallbladder out, which changes a lot of how you process certain kinds of food, particularly fats and things. And he's learning that many of his most loved things, like fried chicken, are really not his friends anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's like he eats something and then he lays there and he like actually puts his hands on his stomach and looks down like, why have you betrayed me?
That's almost – the thing about the gallbladder too is that's also a bit of a warning shot that your body's giving you. You know, that's a little bit of a – that's a harbinger. That's sort of a look. You'll get more of the same if you continue to act this way. And then he's just got – that's what – and what sucks about being a guy like Patrick, where he just – you know, he's just eating with impunity and he's just – you know, and he's – you know, he weighs less now than he did, but he was never like a fat guy, I don't think. I mean, he was, you know, a slender guy. And so now
he's a big, tall, hearty guy who never gets sick up until this happened. So it's like, I can do whatever I like.
And it's the double-pronged thing of he's not only got to ratchet back on all of the horrible foods he likes to eat, but now he's got to learn to enjoy, you know, or at least tolerate eating a bunch of healthy food, which is a thing his body's probably not prepared for at this juncture.
Our marriage has been like a revelation to him when it comes to things like broccoli. You know, which he just absolutely refused to eat when I met him. Now he actually likes quite a bit, but yeah, no, he's still not,
not really happy about it as such.
No, not so much.
Let's do one more here. We'll take a break. Come back with Mr. Big Jim Willig.
Omaha, Nebraska residents have new options when it comes to recycling. They can toss their empty juice and milk cartons in curbside bins, or they can go take their stuff to Brian Gennardo, who is inviting his neighbors to put their stuff on his lawn. Each glass that is dropped on his lawn, each jar, each container of some sort, is one less in the landfill, he says, and his lawn is becoming a community recycling center. The Omaha Public Works Department says that it does recycle glass, and so people can bring those things to them. They shouldn't be just dumping things on his lawn. But Gennardo is calling it a communal effort and is attempting to create a giant mountain of recycled products.
To what end is he?
He doesn't really say. Actually, I guess I don't know. That's the problem with the story, is it doesn't really.
So he just wants a pile of crap
on
his lawn.
I think he thinks he's helping.
Uh-huh.
Like one of his neighbors says, I had glass I'm trying to recycle someplace, and this is close to where I live, so I figured this would be the place to do it.
No,
yeah,
I think
no,
he's
not
doing
really.
Doing it wrong. Okay.
Oh, I guess this is the problem, is that here in Omaha, Nebraska, the only way to truly recycle glass back into bottles is at a place in St. Louis, and the transportation costs are such that if you look at it from a carbon footprint perspective, it doesn't make any sense. So people have not been – I'm getting the gist of the story now. People have not been recycling their glass.
Okay.
So this guy just said he didn't want to, like, throw them away, so he just started collecting them himself and stacking them up on his lawn. And now other people are coming to his house and – putting their empty bottles on his lawn, too.
So it's just become a de facto dump.
Yeah.
Okay.
For glass.
Wonder if he had a wife at some point, you know, like up until a few weeks ago, maybe.
I'm thinking kind of a Richard Dreyfuss-y sort of a thing, where he's trying to form the amount of glass into something he saw in a dream.
I was thinking that, or else he had, it was like the underpants gnomes, except for him it was sort of instead of profit, it was like watchtowers, you know? But he was, you know, he wasn't quite sure how to get from here to there. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Isn't that the watchtowers, the things that's made out of glass or made out of garbage?
It's not made out of garbage, but it was made out of all kinds of scrap metal.
But it was, yeah, just discarded materials.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Back after this with Mr. Big Jim Willig. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
He was killed by a cellular phone explosion. They scattered his ashes across the ocean. The water was used to make baby lotion. The wheels of promotion were set into motion, but the sun still shines in the summertime. I'll be yours if you'll be mine. I tried to change, but I changed my mind. Think I'll have another glass of Mexican wine. Wine. Think I'll have another glass of Mexican wine. summertime. I'll be yours if you'll be mine. I tried to change, but I changed my mind. Think I'll have another glass of Mexican wine, because the sun still shines in the summertime. I'll be yours if you'll be mine. I tried to change, but I changed my mind. Think I'll have another glass of Mexican wine. Think I'll have another glass of Mexican wine. Won't you have another glass of Mexican wine?
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Mr. Big Jim Willig here with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to email, it's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor re-entering the studio right now. Was that the... Did I inadvertently cut you off just now when Jim came into the studio and you said, do we have a few minutes before we're back? And I said, yes.
Yes, you
did.
Is
it because you were planning to use the restroom?
Yes.
Okay.
I said, do we got to play another song? And you said yes. And then I stood up and you went, just a minute. You dashed out in front of me. And
let's be clear. I didn't really dash. I walked at a rate of speed that most people normally... I've walked like a normal...
Are you mocking me?
Walked like a normal guy
I'm
with a...
I'm handicapable, Mr.
I'm just saying there's, you know... Great on a curve when dashing is relative. When It's like you do that thing when we're leaving in the evening, and it's like if we're both heading to the staircase, you actually just step aside to let everybody else go first because you don't want to be, you know.
Right, I don't want to hold people up because I'm slow.
You don't want to be like, yeah, some Idaho driver in front of everybody, right. So it's fine. So I didn't mean to dash in front of you. I really was just trying to.
It's all right. I was able to hold it for the 40 seconds you were gone. Okay. It was fine.
Hey, you know, I got this email right here. It's just the inbox. I haven't bothered to look at the actual email itself. The subject line just says, Nelson Mandela / dildos. And it's like, I almost don't ever want to open the email because what could be contained within this that would justify the subject line? You know, like what could the content of the email be that would require the use of the subject line, Nelson Mandela / dildos? There's really nothing.
Oh, no.
So, you know, we'll open that later on and we'll find out. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program our good friend Mr. Big Jim Willig joining us now for another exciting installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Hello, sir.
Hello.
How's life?
Just another day in the porn mines.
Can you share with us the story that you were just telling us during the break? I only heard a little overview of it. But,
well, it was my Friday, and I had switched with another employee, so I had to work day shifts. So this was like the first time I've ever been like in a porn store in the wee small hours of the morning. And I was always assured that it's like that's very slow, not a whole lot of activity coming and going from the store. There is some, but not
what's
a whole
the high, what's the peak hour at the porn store?
Well, it tends to vary. There is actually an after-work rush. People, like, on their way home from work, so, like, around, say, 6 to about 8 o'clock, we'll get a rush.
Where they're looking at, like, next action item, pleasure wife at 7 p.m. Damn, I'm so unprepared.
Kiss you, Palm Pilot!
Or when you get off work and you realize, another evening alone. How will I fill the remaining hours until I come back to my soulless job?
I'm still depressed and unlikable. How will I solve that tonight?
Which rubber facsimile will be my escort for the evening? Oh, you're new. What's your name? Zoe. Interesting. We actually got in some toys this week that have an entire backstory based on them. They are
really?
These little toys in our masturbator section. And like their name, one's Zoe, one's Cassandra. And you turn over and Zoe is...
Always wanted to be a veterinarian.
Now, are these
social smoker.
Are actually. These the things that just look like the lady's parts?
No, this is even creepier. This is like a small...
Really?
Yeah, no, this is like... Granted, that is like just like an amputee section. Huh? This is kind of sexy. I've always been curious.
You know, all I need is the vagina. So I'll just get one of those.
All those other parts, the talking and the yakking and all the others. You can keep those. I just want like the business end. But no, this is like a small, I'd say maybe foot long size toy.
Is it?
It's weird because it's like
about
a three dimensional.
9 inches.
It's about average. About average. It's this weird thing that looks like a full woman sitting on like a chaise lounge in a provocative area, but she's only like a foot long.
I don't understand.
Now, it gets weirder.
Is it a tiki idol of some kind?
You just... Given to you by Vincent Price.
Yeah.
No, it's weird because...
It's like a little mud flap girl, but three-dimensional.
Well, cyber skin is very, very flexible, but I don't understand where you're just like, oh, I like her, but only tinier and very stretchy.
Is this like if you have a Lilliputian fetish?
Very much so.
So does that mean
we
you're...
We are the little...
You're actually essentially then having sex with a tiny piece of furniture with a small lady on it?
Yes. That is... Wow.
How did they discover that was a thing people wanted to buy, do you suppose?
More terrifying would it be like the think tank where they're just like, all right, what haven't we done that we can do?
Was this some
a
sort of...
tiny sofa with little woman on it.
Was this like a Stonehengian accident, you think, where the guy said, I need something that is 6 feet long and 3 feet high, and the guy came back with like a little tiny miniature thing, and he goes, well, how are we going to sell these? This is a miniature of what I wanted.
Drill a hole in one end.
And then they just discovered a guy went, that's exactly what I've been looking for.
Very much so. And it is very much, it's scary that the skin itself is so flexible. But I'm just like, wherein that is it sexy? Because it's maybe 3 or 4 inches larger than the unit, the part of you that's going to be going into it anyway.
It seems like there's some unpleasant compressing. Beyond the normal enjoyable compressing.
Or very pleasant pressing.
I don't know. It seems like at a certain point that's going to be a whole, you know, that's going to be the mind caved in and maybe, Timmy's never getting out of there.
Maybe sometime I can talk to my boss about bringing in some...
What's the name of the item?
I can't remember the specific name of the product, but I know that the toy that I'm thinking of, his name is Cassandra, or Zoe.
I'm sorry.
Z-O-E, Zoe. Yeah. And if you turn the box over that it comes in, you just hear frantic typing from both of them.
Is it called the Bordello Zoe by Topco?
Yes. Is it the woman?
Oh, Topco.
Oh, I made the mistake of going to the images. Now it's just nothing but porn shots.
But no, if you flip it around to the back, it gives you all like the finer points of Zoe. Information such as...
Her growth was stunted almost immediately. She's an all-over binding. Oh, my God.
She's a social... Yes.
That's it.
Okay, that is exactly
it. I gotta find
this. This is $112 for...
Yeah.
Lifelike Cyberskin, a... I'm reading now. This is considered social news. I think this is called the device is called a stroker. Realistic hand sculpted replica of a woman down to the last strand of hair. Zoe relaxes on her side.
Oh.
Relaxes on her side, ready for anything.
You didn't mention it was also just like all flesh colored.
Oh, by the way, it is all flesh colored. What color is non creepy when you're dealing with a tiny woman on a tiny Jane's lounge?
In my mind, I saw like a little red velvet sofa with a. I thought they'd like paint them so that they would look like
a
sofa and a lady.
No, this is like one of those.
That belittles it.
This is one of.
This is $84.
This is like one of those Revell models before you actually buy the paints on the side. You know, you've just got it assembled, but the stickers and the stickers on the glaze haven't gone on yet. So, you know what this is like? So this is like...
Pinewood Derby Girl. Just a block of wood you got to whittle out yourself.
You can't do that this week because Don and I have been giggly all week long anyway because we've been so freaking tired. Here's the thing about this. This is like... When you see like it's like a portrait, sort of the Picasso's woman reclining on sofa five, except it is like a painting you would see of like a Rubenesque nude woman reclining on a sofa on her side, sort of facing you, the viewer. But they've then just taken it and made it into
you can have sex with it.
Yeah, but they made it into a three-dimensional latex thing that you can hump. Which I guess, you know, I mean, it's like, I guess this is sort of like the porn version of the guy who can make anything into a bong.
Yeah.
I do like the way they make it sound so appealing, though, in the product description. Her large breasts rest against each other realistically. You know, realistically for a woman who is all the same color and only 3 inches tall.
She ponders the eternal verities of life.
And then Stroker stretches to accommodate penis, then returns to original shape. Also, Ribbed Love Tunnel.
Which was my failed band name in high school. I don't know why we didn't get more booking.
That's the most popular ride at Pleasure Island.
If you flip it over on the back, it gives you like a full rundown of all her characteristics. Not available for short notice meetings. Like you have to make an appointment with your toy, supposedly.
I don't understand why she supposed to be like a replica of a call girl?
I guess. Yeah, and it's
why is she, let me ask you this. Let me just skip to the bottom of the page. Why so small? I mean, really, it seems like who is the target audience for a fully full-bodied, you know, head-to-toe, more or less realistic depiction of a woman, but it's only like 8 inches high and it's also fastened to a sofa? It seems an oddly specific toy.
Well, we get a lot of just unique toys in, and we will order them from our dispatcher or whatever you want to call them, and... Basically, just to see if they will sell. We've got some toys that we've ordered just to sort of see, and they've been sitting on the shelves for years.
Is this for guys who fantasize about being a giant?
By the way, Zoe's colleagues, if you will, come in different positions.
Yes.
So check in. You might want to take a look at Bordello Saskia, S-A-S-K-I-E. Bordello...
Oh, yeah.
We also,
we've got her and we've got Zoe, yeah.
Remember when I told you about the woman I knew with the enormous Hooters that was in the movie with Ron Jeremy?
I looked her
This is the position she was in, and they were smacking her in the face, and she looked very uncomfortable.
Okay.
But funny thing is,
I'd like to welcome the KPAM listeners who, after sampling us on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, decided to become Rick Emerson Show listeners.
Wet your whistle every Friday.
Welcome to the show.
I wonder about the guy, because here's the thing. There must be some guy somewhere at a sketchboard or whatever who originally designed and dreamed up, conceived, designed, created this. Just like there was a guy who created, you know, the Archie comics at one point.
And then they had to hire an actual sculptor to do the original form that they made the molds from.
Like the automotive sculptor, where it's just a big hunk of clay, and he's just like, slowly sculpting the woman as she will eventually
Or it just came to him in a dream or a vision or something. What would it be like if I lived on top of a beanstalk? What would it be like to have sex with women then? I will make it real. Jesus.
Anyone, by the way, who doubts at all that men objectify women and want to know what we mean by objectify, just go to one of these sites and look at how many different ways you can buy just a woman's parts.
Okay, I don't know the last time you looked at what a vibrator looks like.
Yeah.
Or a dildo, but that ain't the whole guy. That's not even the part that can pay for dinner.
And I will point out the fact that is a very, very small amount of our
section
toy
of the marketplace
section that we have in our store. We have one wall versus eight different aisles.
I'm just saying sounds like somebody's willfully overlooking reality. That's what it sounds like to me. That sounds like someone who's either never really been to a porn store or just is willfully disregarding, what are those things called, facts.
It could just be the fact that I'm just looking at 7,000 plastic parts.
You're looking at one
site.
It just, yeah.
I mean, that's yeah, so that's
right,
I mean that is see, but that's the thing that like
going
guys
back to Google.
Like there's guys have have wondered about that for the longest time, like why that isn't objectification. And the answer is it probably is, but we just don't care.
Well, so. I love in the movie Orgasmo, this incredible scene towards the end where it's Ron Jeremy and I think two other actors having the discussion as opposed to what it is that porn objectifies. Does it objectify women or does it objectify men? And Ron Jeremy comes up with this like a epiphany where it's just like it objectifies one and the other, so hence it objectifies people. So no one side can lay claim that, it only does it to this side. No, it only does it to that. No. Both sides are equally objectified. And that's probably the reason why we're drawn to it in the first place.
Well, I remember when Laura and I were first together, and I've talked about this, that she had was not too long at a college at that point, and she had been she minored in women's studies. And so we had any number of fascinating, compelling discussions that went till late at night, because I'm a fairly horrible person. And, and it's like we were like, it's that thing of like I was over at her place for the first time and I was looking at her CD collection and her movie collection and her books just to see like who is Laura? And I was looking at her books and the first thing I saw was that she was reading a Gloria Steinem book. And I made some, idiot guy crack about the Gloria Steinem, I just said something idiotic. But then led to this long discussion about feminism and men and women and, pornography and objectification and whatever. And she was talking about, she said, porn, for example, porn just constantly objectifies women. And I said, give me a for instance, like for example. And she talked about, some example that they had brought up in women's studies class where there was there was one guy and he was sitting basically just a guy like reclining in like a piece of wicker furniture while he was being pleasured by like 17 women at once. And she said, so like the women are just there for his pleasure. They don't even really exist. They're just there, to get him off. Like the women don't even really. And I said, then reflexively, then mathematically, you would have to acknowledge that if it were reversed and if it was 17 guys just taking it out on some chick, that they would be objectified and it would all be because it's for the glory of her. She would be the powerful one in the situation. And she said, well, no. And I said, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, she's being objectified there. And I said, well, you've just magically, in the space of two sentences, constructed a world in which there's nothing women can ever do in which they're not victims. And that's the problem with that line of thinking, is that there's just no – there is no right answer there. It becomes a thing in which everything seems to be deliberately designed to make women seem more fragile than they really are. And that's why it confuses men.
I've never understood why the parts – the toys that are designed to look like men, mm-hmm. why they really need to. Because, if you're a lady and you're buying it, well, even if you're a guy and you're using it, while it's being used, while it's serving its function, you're not really looking at it.
Well, what really kind of intrigues me is we do also have a large amount of lesbian couples that come into the store, a lot of which are basically very much, non-male oriented. However, I would say virtually all of them come in and purchase a strap-on. which is just kind of intriguing to me. It's like you're living in this anti-male world, but at the same time, you need that kind of, why put it there? Why not put it on some other part of the body that doesn't sort of objectify where the male, you know, member
is? And as you know, they do sell them that they can be strapped on, like, your thigh.
In your mouth.
See, now, this is, you know, it's really, conversations like this are odd, and not because it's just dildos and humping, but because it's, see, this is those strange moments on the show where it almost sounds like we're actually having a real substantive discussion about philosophy, which kind of weirds me out occasionally. Like, I feel like one of us needs to fart or belch or something. But it's strange because you are highlighting an interesting difference in the, Rick Emerson says, speaking for the lesbian community, as I often do, you are highlighting an interesting dichotomy in the lesbian community, as I understand it, and to some degree have sort of experienced it. I'll get to that in a second, but the idea that there is not just two, but in this case, there, you know, there is the difference between being a living in a non-male dynamic as opposed to living in an anti-male dynamic. And there are, just like there are men who don't like women, there are women who don't like men. I have to say, one of the most surreal conversations I have ever witnessed was when I was first with Lara, who had living in Utah. If you are not a white straight male in Utah, you're a minority in like 100 different ways, and and so anybody who does not fit that paradigm, you know, you tend to stick together. But anyway, so as a consequence, she had a lot of lesbian friends, and when we were first getting together, she and I were going into a movie or something, or we were going to dinner, but we stopped by and we were having, I don't know, she was having a drink with some of her friends, and so it was me and her and this kind of room full of women, and I swear to God, when we got there, they were just at the tail end of some argument that two of them had been having, and it was over this issue of having a phallus-shaped sex toy, because one of the women in the argument felt like if they were going to reject the male paradigm, then they had to reject the male paradigm altogether, and
absolutely,
that meant rejecting the phallus as an object, that the phallus should not be the center of the woman's sexual pleasure or the giver of sexual pleasure. And the other woman said – the other woman was making the counterargument, which I would probably make, which is that – you know, which is just like – it just comes. It's just a matter of nature. Like it's just the part that fits the car. You know, like
for the ignition.
Yeah, I mean, really. And it seems to me like anything else, by definition, by nature design, anything else is not really going to get the job done to the right degree. Which seems like you're just losing it. Seems like you're on the losing end of that equation. It seems like that's way more punishment for you, than it is for like the male world by you rejecting the phallus shaped sex toy, which is what the other woman was saying.
And really, the thing is that sexual response and the things that turn us on is so crazy and wild and varied, and that's where I think people having arguments like that lose like sight of what they're doing, is that you can be a lesbian and actually be turned on by the sight of a male erection. It doesn't mean you actually want to sleep with men any more than
I know exactly what you were going to say right there.
Yeah,
any more than what, Don?
No, you really don't know what I was going to say.
Okay. You can finish the sentence. Any more than what?
Actually, I don't even know what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
I think – I don't know. I honestly don't know where I was going with that. But here's the thing. But then there are women who actually part of their being lesbian is the fact that they were traumatized at some point and they want a phallus-shaped object because – physiologically, that actually can feel good and enhance pleasure, but they don't want anything that looks male. But at the same time, the thing is, it's all over the place. And whenever you say that it's about being a lesbian, for example, is about rejecting males, there are women who are gay because, they were raped. There are women who are gay because they're just gay. They just want to have sex with women, but they still think, like, some men are really hot.
But my question is, every time I ask this, I'm not sure if it just comes across as being too chauvinistic. But if that's the case, if a woman has been traumatized by a man or what have you, or just chooses to live a lifestyle where they are just going to associate majority of their time and their relationships with women, why is it then that most of the women in that paradigm tend to be ones that dress with short hair, with clothing that's more associated with men? I mean, we have the couples that come in the door, they come in, they walk with a certain stature, they have a certain type of attitude. It harkens me back to like Boys Don't Cry with Tina Brendan. You know, she had this mentality where she felt that there was this other personality kind of inside her, and it was mostly a male one. where in the same time, you know, the same time, sort of hated.
It is an interesting question. Yeah. I mean, because we all know what we're talking about. They're, I mean, they're just like they're very effeminate gay men. They're big butch gay women who, right. I mean, you look at who, I mean, everybody's had that experience where, like, you see some guy stocking shelves in a Safeway and you go, hey, what aisle of the fan belt? And you go, oh, not a guy, you know, and you realize it's a woman. And, you know, it's whatever. Not like I care, not like anybody cares, and there's nothing wrong with it. But it does, it is interesting in the sense that you think, well, if you are a woman, if you're a gay woman and you're going to be with a woman who is so overtly masculine, like in every external way, you almost do then wonder, like, well, how fine is the gradation of the sexual interest that you wouldn't just take the extra step and just be with a guy who looks like that? In other words, if you're with a woman who seems to be embracing the male look and exterior in every way, why not the extra whatever? And I'm not saying there isn't a reason. I'm just saying that's one of those. That's one of those reasons. That's one of the reasons why like I never have any issue when they, you know, as much as we talk about weird studies and scientific experiments or whatever during Legion of News. I mean, it's like you could just spend, you know, billions of dollars and thousands of hours talking to people and studying the brain and how people read and never understand why people choose what they choose or how the brain makes its decisions.
Well, conversely, you can also say the same about men who want to have, say, a homosexual experience and then they're sleeping with, like, somebody who's a cross-dresser.
Put on a wig. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, well, why do you want this person to look like a lady if obviously what you're after is someone who is not a lady?
Yeah.
Here's a weird thing. It's because the human brain is crazy.
No, it really is. Well, it's not even
and
that
love
it's...
love is a battlefield.
I don't even think it's that your brain is crazy. I think it's what... here's the thing. I think the human brain to us right now... And, you know, and I think it goes without saying, I mean, for all of us, I think I could speak for the room, when I say that, like, none of us care what anybody you do or what you're into or whatever. I mean, as long as everybody in the situation is you know, consent, doesn't matter, don't care.
And I would venture to say that every single one of us has some particular secret thing that turns us on that we would not tell each other about at this particular moment.
Robots.
I mean, I think everybody's got something. That it's like, I'm never telling anyone this, you know?
Well, no, very, very true. And the thing is, the world that we're living in is an ever-evolving one, that the market of adult entertainment is one that is, you know, proven to be virtually recession-proof. Because
seriously, you guys must never. By the way, just now, I was just waiting to see if I was going to have the opportunity to use the cricket sound effect, but I guess not. I'll put that away.
So crickets, that's what really gets you going?
No, when it's exactly,
cricket humper.
It started when I read the works of George Sheldon, and then it all just snowballed from there.
Pinocchio's my favorite.
Call
Disney
me
movie.
Tucker. Anyway. Well, yeah, because my thing about it is what we were just talking about, the thing about the human brain. I think that to us now in this room, again, however, you know, whatever the fact that we don't, you know, we don't care. We don't, not like we're passing moral judgment on anybody. You know, whatever gets everybody off, hey, yeah, have at it. You know,
provided no one else is getting hurt and you're consenting adults.
Or getting hurt against their will.
Yeah.
That's my thing. It's the standard as long as everybody consents thing. Because I'm only half joking when I say this, that – you know, really, if everybody in the world was just getting laid like however they wanted to, really, the number of problems we have would not vanish, but I think it would diminish greatly. Yeah. Because when you think about just how many religions cause violence in the world, I mean, and I don't just mean, you know, and I'm not just talking about Muslim extremists. I mean, just religions in general.
Yeah.
And you think about how many religions spring out of sexual repression and sexual oppression and sexual frustration and anger and guys who are pissed off that some girl wouldn't hump them behind the bleachers. And so they start some church, you know, where they get permission to, you know, like, you know, to flog women every other Tuesday or something. You know, if everybody would just sort of, you know, get their basket weaved a little, you know, a little more often, I think that we would probably live in a more pleasant world. But I do think that the human brain to us is sort of like the weather was to ancient man, where it's like everything in the sky was a god because it didn't make any sense and it was so unbelievably and you couldn't figure out why anything happened. You know, I don't know, water just fell out of the sky and now it's gone. And then the next day
must be a god.
Yeah, and then I mean, you know, I don't know, these small stones fell out of the sky, but then they turned into water, and it must be a
what
god.
What did you do?
And I think that's the thing with our brain. So when Don says, like, everybody's brain is crazy, I think that's true to the extent that it seems that way to us because everything in your brain happens for a reason, but it's like the reasons are so impossibly labyrinthine. They're so unbelievably complex. Like, the math to get from A to Z in your head is so detailed that we'll never, ever be able to figure it out.
Plus, we just keep trying to quantify everything, particularly sex. We try to quantify everything, even, you know, and the best we can do, it's like, it sounds like you're being incredibly tolerant and insightful when you say, you know, well, there's a spectrum, the spectrum, either, now in zero, you're 100% straight, and like, you know, 10, you're 100% gay, and almost everybody falls somewhere in that spectrum. And the thing is, it's like, you know, something, I bet, yeah, everybody falls somewhere in that spectrum. And a lot of people just bounce around all the time.
The spectrum changes.
And then there's just all that stuff that isn't even on that chart that goes through your head. You
there know? Are some people that are just non-sexual beings. That's not as big a deal to them as it is to other people. And those people are become, you know, the being like, well, what's wrong with you? Why is it that you're not in a spectrum?
I know a woman
this?
Who said this about, a woman who actually said about sex. I don't remember how this came up. It just came up at one point in conversation where she said she wasn't asexual. I mean, she had a boyfriend on a day. Had some kind of sexual relationship, but she actually said at one point, and to the best of my knowledge, and she said this is true, and I believe her. She always said very forthrightly that she was never like wasn't abused, didn't have any weird. She said that there were no issues in the past that would have. She wasn't traumatized in any way. There wasn't anything that would have happened that would have caused this, and I believe her when she says that. But she said that she had sex, and she said, well, I just don't really see the big deal, you know. And I said, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, I mean, you know, it's okay. I don't get why people are so into it. And I, you know, and that, I'm not saying she didn't feel that way, but that is one of those things, again, where you, people who are just, are a place that, it's not even not on that spectrum, you know, it's just like, it's like when you hear about the universe existing in multiple dimensions at once, it's like she's on a spectrum that exists clearly for her, but that does not intersect with, like, the spectrum as we traditionally understand it.
And that's one of the saddest things. I remember reading an article about people who consider themselves asexual. And having to form support groups and go to like conventions and meet other people because they get treated as freaks more than people who like are into stuff that's freaky.
Right.
Yeah.
Just that people are actively cruel to people who just go, I'm just not interested. Sorry.
I'd rather tweet or whatever.
You know, here's a fascinating thing to me, talking about guys who, you know, the guys who are on the spectrum and are either in denial about something or just have an oddly specific, the whole like, you know, when I have sex with a guy, but then dress him like a lady. Here's a fascinating thing. If you've spent any – I think Dan Savage talked about this, I don't know, a while back. But there was – if you go to – like if you spend any time looking at, you know, like online classifieds or your Craigslist or whatever – and it can't just be the same like three guys all the time. There's just no way. The staggering number of guys who are wanting to hook up with transsexuals, not even just cross-dressers. I mean, not transvestites, but they have full-on transsexuals where they are either in some stage of the transformation from man to woman to woman to man, or they are hermaphroditic, you know, or they're just, you know, but there's an actual physical, you know, meshing of the two genders, not just, you know, the way that they dress. It's astounding. Yeah. I mean, it really is just mind-blowing, the number of guys who are looking for that.
Well, what it is it allows them to fulfill a gratification while still sort of clinging. It allows them to entertain other than heterosexual interests, while at the same time holding still to the, well, it's still like 99% woman. There's just that one thing that she's got that makes it kind of, you know, odd or hanky. And people assume that any kind of play in that general area of a man is considered gay. It's not, actually. The prostate is pretty much what the equivalent is to the female G-spot. You know, certain, you know, play with that particular area can grant very, very satisfactory, you know, experiences. Not from personal experience. I have sat on a couple of picket fences by accident. Nothing really intentional there.
I'd say that you were doing it wrong.
Oh, okay. Well, either way.
Give me something sharp and pointy.
But it comes down to what emotional investment you're willing to make in that other person. And that's really the scary point, because people realize then that, oh, well, you know, you can have feelings towards someone that is not necessarily of the opposite sex. And, you know, it can be okay. I know plenty of dudes that have dude crushes on other dudes. And it's like, that's fine. But there's that one line that they won't cross, even though it's like they flirt with that concept, you know, almost endlessly.
Here's another weird thing that you'll see if you – because I got to tell you, like online, if you haven't – if somebody hasn't like carved out a few minutes of their day to look at online, you know, classifieds, like whether it's just like personals or the casual hookup or the casual encounter thing. That is like, I mean, that's just a day's worth of entertainment right there. I mean, that is just like a, I mean, really, I mean, you got like a good 7-8 hours of your life that you can just while away reading those things. But here's another thing you see a lot of. The number of there's two things. You'll see women who want to hook up with another woman while her husband's at work. You know, it's like, you know, and it's not like they're looking for a threesome. It's not like they're looking for like, you know, a treat from a man's birthday. It's like, well, my husband's off at the tool and die factory. Why don't you? But you will also see this. You'll see a lot of guys who specifically, and they're gay men, men who identify as gay, gay guys who specifically are looking for straight guys.
Yeah.
That they can just, you know, it's like, and they'll be like, you come over, you know, you come over, you unzip, bada bing, you're taken care of, then you can leave. And they will specify, like, I'm not looking for gay guys. I only want straight guys to come over with this, which just raises, like, so many questions.
Yeah.
I mean, that there's so much revealed and yet not answered by just that that one sort of style of ad, which, again, you see all the time. All the time.
And you can really only answer that ad once before. No, I'm kidding.
Well, we were having, there was some story we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, and there's this entire, I can't remember what the word is.
Men who have sex with men?
Yeah, this whole.
It's an acronym, yeah.
Yeah, for guys who have sex with other guys, but they're not gay.
It's a. I saw it in the New York Times. There was a thing they were talking about STD and disease prevention and education in the various communities, and they use that, because we've all, they use that thing, you know, the gay LLBGBTQ whatever, and it's like gay, queer, lesbian, bisexual, whatever. But then there was this thing at the end that says MSM, and I thought MSM, and the only thing I've ever heard called that was the mainstream media or multi something marketing or whatever, and I was like MSM, and it's men who have sex with men, and that is guys who like to get it on with other guys but don't consider themselves emotionally or attitudinally gay at all. And so I think that is, I guess, the opposite of these guys here who were looking for so the guys who placed the ads are looking for those guys.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, maybe that's just like a taboo thing or if it's, I don't know what that's all about.
Nah.
It's all very weird.
Yeah.
So there should be like an 800 number you can call where you can have these questions answered, where you can just go like, men who have sex with men, but don't think they're gay. What's up with that? And then a guy
Fantasy
just tells you the answer.
Fantasy for adults only, 503-239-6969.
All right then. Well, hello, everyone. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. In just a few minutes here, we'll do another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. Here is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Let's do our Taser Watch.
Here's your Taser Watch for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don Taylor with your Taser Watch.
This is a follow-up on a story that I believe we covered way back when we first started doing this almost a year ago. Three police officers from El Reno, Oklahoma, will face trial for repeatedly shooting an 86-year-old woman with a taser. The officers went to the home of Lona Varner on December 22, 2009, after her grandson and a health care provider called 911 asking for medical assistance. Varner, 86, apparently threatened them with a knife from her bed, proclaiming that she killed four Japs in World War II and would not bat an eye killing them. And so even though she was in bed and on an oxygen tank, they tased her.
She did have a knife, though?
She did have a knife.
Okay.
She pulled it out, like, from under the pillow or under the mattress or something and said, I killed Japs, I'll kill you, too.
That's not Don Taylor saying that, by the way.
No.
You got to admire an old woman, though, who's armed with a huge knife.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something great about that.
And then they decided the officers who attacked her used excessive force on the elderly woman and tasered her. In light of the fact that she was, yes, bedridden and on oxygen.
That's what she wanted you to believe.
Another officer is accused of ordering one of the officers to begin firing the taser. And the judge also gave the go-ahead for Varner's grandson to pursue his claim of unlawful arrest after he tried to protect his grandmother, shouting, don't tase my granny.
Okay, but, I mean, to be fair, though, I mean, you know, if they're at the house and a woman's wielding a knife at them, I mean, what are they going to do? I mean,
well, they could have
turn off her oxygen.
Well, they could have, like, maybe backed away from the bed.
Yeah, but at some point you got to deal. I mean, you can't just be waving a knife at a cop. Like, what are they supposed to do?
Well, the thing is, they were called there, he had called them because he needed assistance for something. I can't remember what the reason was.
I was going to say, what is it that a woman on oxygen that's bedridden is doing that would need the police
the cops to show up?
And
right?
And I'm trying to remember the original thing. It had nothing to do with her, whatever the thing was. Her grandson had called because I think it was that she was sick. He had called. I remember now. He had called an ambulance because she wasn't feeling well. And he called an ambulance. He called 911. 911 either misunderstood him or just sent out some kind of a general call. And cops showed up instead of the ambulance. And the cops came in and was like, "What's all this then?" And then she pulled out the knife.
That was just a door prize.
She wanted nothing to do with the police. And that's the thing is, what could they have done? They could have just stepped back two steps. I mean, she was in bed.
Well, yeah, I think that I think you were right. You should have just not turned off the oxygen.
Just stepped on the hose.
Turn it down a little bit till she starts to get a little wheezy, drops the knife, you cuff her up, and then give her back her oxygen. You're not.
Let's be honest. I just try to find excuses for cops to tase people all the time. That's it. Because like that's our bread and butter here. I don't want to cut off that. I don't cut off the story supply.
Bite that hand that feeds you.
Seriously. I mean, that's a conveyor belt. I can't interrupt. So all right. Yeah. And so there's going to be some sort of a lawsuit or some sort of a whatever.
Yeah, so he's going to pursue his unlawful arrest suit, and they are going to be able to charge the officers with excessive use of force.
Maybe it'll be one of those great like computer animations they did with the Al Gore massage thing, like some sort of the Japanese news outlet will do like a CGI of like recreating the tasing for us. We can hope. Here's that was your Taser Watch for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio program.
My God, it's warm.
You're just saying that because of all the reclining Zoe talk or whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's that.
Sue, while we're here, we'll take a small break, come back with Humor Meet Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willie.
Okay, well, if we're only going to do one more, then I need to do the Corpse Watch. So we're going to go from watch to watch here, because I have to do this Corpse Watch.
All right, here's your Corpse Watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson Radio program. I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of that's dead and gone. Yeah, tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones. Here's Don Taylor with your Corpse Watch.
Dominican health officials say they have removed the mummified remains of a fetus from the abdomen of a 59-year-old woman who had no clue what was causing the sharp pain in her stomach for decades. Miletus Roman is the chief gynecologist at Luis Eduardo Ibar Hospital in Santo Domingo. He said the woman had carried the petrified fetus for at least 30 years.
Wow.
The Haitian woman told physicians she had long experienced pain, but had never received adequate medical attention until she recently entered the public hospital with digestive complaints. Roman told reporters late Monday the remains of the fetus weighed 3 pounds, 12 ounces.
Good God almighty. And so she presumably, if it had not caused her pain, would have just been sort of lugging that around like, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And you hear about these occasionally where it's like, the pregnancy goes more than sideways, and it's just sort of, you know,
slightly
just
askew.
Yeah, you know, it's just sort of there, like, you know, just for the duration or whatever. That must be what a weird chain of questions that must prompt in your head, though. Like, if you're that woman, you know,
you're going back and saying, "Okay, so I would have been about 29."
Yeah,
who was I seeing?
How would you even do the math on that? Oh, good God almighty.
Yeah, but how is it that, like, you know, a fetus of, a dead fetus of that magnitude for 30 years didn't cause, like, death? I would have assumed that within a year she would have been dead unless she had some kind of, like, adamantium-laced, you know, placenta.
Well, and also, I mean, do you wonder if, like, as the doctor, he's going, okay, we're just going to get an X-ray and we're just going to do, and if there was just a whole, you know, you know, as they just, I mean, that's going to be like seeing the face on Mars.
Well, let's go take a look and see what's in here. Oh, my goodness.
That's weird.
Hey, Jim, come here.
Does this look like a fetus to you? And he goes, nah, it's a coffee stain on the monitor. Are you sure? No, you know, I mean, that's
a fetus.
That's a thing you wouldn't expect to see looking back at you. I would imagine that'll come back to you when you try to sleep later that night.
Eyes pop open.
Okay.
Basket case 4.
Okay. Here's your Corpse Watch for Friday on the... So sorry. I'm digging
up home. Once again, welcome to all of the folks who came from Cape Ham to join us here at the Rick Emerson Show.
Well, to be fair, we might as well just, I mean, there's no sense in starting with half measures. Throw them into the deep end. If you can swim out of this, then you're good. All right. We're back after this with Mr. Big Jim Willing and another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Stay right there. We return. This is the Rick Emerson radio program for Friday right here on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
This bulkhead's built of fallen brethren bones. We all do what we can. We endure our fellow man. And we sing our songs to the head frames, kicks and moans. And it's one, two, three on the wrong side of the lee. What were you meant for? What were you meant for? And it's seven, eight, nine. You get your shuffle back in line. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again. And you won't make a dime on this gray granite mountain mine. Of dirt you're made, and the dirt you will return. While we're living here, let's get this little one thing clear. There's plenty of men to die, you don't jump your turn. And it's one, two, three on the wrong side of the lead. What were you meant for? What were you meant for? And it's seven, eight, nine, you get your shuffle back in line. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again. Make it to 10, you won't make it again. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Strung out on heroin on the outskirts. Well, I'm sitting here playing Russian roulette with my pearl-handled gun. The county won't give me any more methadone, and they cut off your welfare check. Carolina, hold me tighter. I think I'm sinking down, and I'm all strung out.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Okay, so I opened the email that where the subject line was Nelson Mandela / dildos.
Oh, yeah.
So apparently, this is great on like 100 different levels. Someone, so this is from a listener, our listener Kara, who says, I had to explain this serial comma or Oxford comma to someone and gave him the following section of the Wikipedia entry regarding serial commas in which they give an example of unresolved ambiguity by using the following sentence. The Times, this is the London Times, Times once published an unintentionally humorous description of Peter Ustinov, noting that, quote, highlights of his global tour include encounters with Nelson Mandela, comma, an 800-year-old demigod and a dildo collector. This would still be ambiguous if a serial comma were added, as Mandela could then be mistaken for a demigod, although he would be precluded from being a dildo collector.
How so?
Well, it's... What are you really asking? I was about to go, here's the thing with the Oxford comma, Jim.
No, I was just saying, why would he be precluded?
Well, because it has to do with the placement of the comma and what is included of the following, whatever they are, conjunctive phrases or whatever, which are joined to the primary conjunctive phrase in the sentence or blah, 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 blah. It's like when you say, never mind. I was just going to open a whole thing about the serial comma and no one cares.
No. I mean, I care.
Yeah,
but
you and I are on the same page, I think, anyway. So it's like I think I've changed the only mind that's probably going to be changed by that or not changed. But I think, you and I are on the same page.
Yeah.
I'm
a big fan of the Oxford comma.
As you should be, because you are a fan of using the English language with a modicum of correctness. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget, today's program is brought to you by a series of business partners, including but not limited to Squires Electric. You can find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com or calling 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. They have to make this program possible. And if you are dealing with electrical issues at your home or your business, or you got to have some sort of repair or some sort of an upgrade that you're going to be dealing with in the future, and the sort of thing you've been dreading it, you've been putting it off, you haven't wanted to do it, you wanted to postpone it, hand it off to somebody else, that somebody else is here at Squires Electric. And you can be assured that when they come to your house, that they come to your business, and they make sure that everything is working in absolute tip-top top condition. By the time they leave, everything is going to be as it should be. Any errors, any glitches are going to be fixed. Your electricity is going to work properly. The wiring is not going to be unsafe. It's not going to be dangerous. It's going to be laid out correctly and easily, and it's going to be done with a maximum of efficiency and a minimum of cost to you. They're going to do it as well as it can possibly be done. They're going to do it right the first time, and your house is going to be a wreck when they leave, and you are going to be a better person for it. So you can contact them at SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. They've been in Portland for 13 years. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors, and they help to make this fine radio program possible. Squires Electric. Ask for them by name, won't you? SquiresElectric.com or you can call 503-252-1609. Without further ado, ladies and gentlefolk, it is time once again for another exciting installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Here is your host, Big Jim Willig.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emerson. Well, I wanted to do something different for April Fool's Day, so I decided to discuss a comic that I'm not very fond of. nor do I really understand, get, or in any way see what this person brought to the comedy landscape. So here goes. It is said that there is a fine line between genius and madness. Comedians are those who attempt to straddle, snort, and strip away this line. For example, the style of humor known as observational comedy points out the lunacy inherent in all the things that we take for granted every day. However, being able to see life from both sides of the mirror can blur your own reality, making it hard for you to be fully understood by the audience. Suddenly, the performance doesn't end on the stage. Life takes on and acts its own. Keep going into the schism, and maybe you don't want to be understood. Maybe you're laughing at the audience's inability to not see the madness for what it is. Or maybe you just like smacking around women while goofing on Elvis. I don't know. But Andy Kaufman knows. Or maybe Bob Zmuda knows. Or Tony Clifton. Maybe I'm Tony Clifton. And you're Bob Zmuda. In a world of Andy Kaufmans. Who knows? All I know is deep down, I've never liked Kaufman's approach.
I would like to do for you some imitations.
Really? You gonna impersonate somebody other than a social retard with no real act?
You know what, Mr. Lawler? I've heard all these things you've been saying about me on television. You want to wrestle me? You want to wrestle me, my infra-style? All right, fine. I'm not afraid of you, Mr. Lawler, because let me tell you something. True, I only wrestle women, but I've wrestled women that are a lot bigger and stronger than you.
Guess not. Some refer to Kaufman as a misunderstood prophet. These people are the same idiots that think Family Guy is still fresh and original. If beating the same tired joke into the ground 5 minutes longer than is comfortable is what passes for clever, then how come Kathy Griffin's My Life on the D-List finally got canceled after only 6 seasons?
Everybody's so stupid. I don't like nobody so stupid.
Seriously, I only get 1 season of Firefly, but this ginger scarecrow gets to natter on for the better part of half a decade? But I'm getting off track here. Andy Kaufman was a mid-level comic with a data complex that to this day I still feel is overrated. But I'll let the panel decide. So with that, I turn things over to the great Gatsby himself, Mr. Rick Emerson, and the only woman to pin Jerry the King Lawler in 2 out of 3 falls, Don Taylor. Your thoughts on the better late than never, Andy Kaufman.
Don Taylor?
Well, I will say, I can certainly appreciate, I try very hard to just acknowledge that, yeah, humor is subjective. Not everybody likes the same thing. And I respect your not liking Andy Kaufman. In fact, I even understand it. And yet, when I'm sitting here listening to him doing his, like, foreign man character, I'm listening him do that thing on the bongo drums, I started laughing just hearing those little bits. I love Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And I'll have to admit that for a lot of it, I'm at a loss to explain why. Part of it is, I think, that I'm a little bit older, and I experienced Andy Kaufman when the world first discovered Andy Kaufman. Mm-hmm. You know, I first saw him on TV. I always remember the first time I saw him on TV. He was a regular on a Dick Van Dyke summer replacement comedy variety show. And he came out and he did the bit that he later did on Saturday Night Live, where he did that thing of being like this sort of weird, creepy, retarded foreign guy and doing, you know, the imitations, and then they're all exactly the same. You know, yeah. The Archie Bunker, oh, meathead, you get out of my chair, which in and of itself was kind of funny, but not really funny. And then I will do the Elvis Presley, and then doing this sort of insanely good dead-on Elvis impression.
Yeah.
And I, as a younger, this was, you know, the era, too, that Steve Martin was starting to really hit with the same sort of kind of Dada-esque, weirdly philosophical and off-the-wall kind of humor. But watching this, it was one of the few times I can remember I literally fell off the couch. I was laying on the couch in my parents' living room, and I rolled off of the couch.
Yeah.
And I've always loved him. I saw an exhibit at the Laguna Beach Art Museum once when they showed a whole bunch of old Ernie Kovacs TV specials and TV programs he did. And by way of comparison, showed a TV special that Andy Kaufman did as well to sort of illustrate that it was the same sort of playing with the medium and just doing really odd things to kind of push the boundaries of what you can get away with and what people will find funny when they don't really actually even understand what you're doing. And it's a very difficult, I still don't really get and still don't even find funny a lot of the stuff that he did. I will never understand what the point was of that whole wrestling women thing.
Yeah.
Just don't get it. Never found it amusing. But the thing is, I think people finding him funny was always kind of beside the point. I read an interview once with a comedian. I can't remember who it was, but someone who had been in the clubs at the same time Kaufman was. And one night he got up on stage and he was one of the last people on. And he got up and said that he was going to sing 100 Bottles of Beer on the Wall. And he started singing 100 Bottles of Beer on the Wall and kept singing it and didn't stop. And people got up and left. And by the time he finished, he was getting down. He said that it was really funny for a while. Then it wasn't funny at all. Then it started to be funny again because it had been going on for so long. And then finally, by the end of it, there was just nobody but the comics were left in the club standing by the bar, like cheering him on, counting him down to the end of 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall. And he got down to like 3 bottles of beer on the wall, and then he quit. And he wouldn't finish it. And it enraged them. And that's, I think, a really good illustration of what it was he was doing a lot with his comedy, that it wasn't even about entertainment, and it wasn't about making people laugh. It was some kind of, in many ways in his own head, it was some kind of weird social experiment.
Yeah. Well, you know, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I know. And Andy Kaufman's one of those guys that it's like in a weird way, and this is not has nothing to do with this as such, but in a weird way, it's one of those things you almost hate to get brought up in conversation because you realize that there is just no reconciling the two camps. There is no reconciling the he's a genius, you know, he's a jackass.
Yeah.
You fall into one of the two, and perhaps unsurprisingly, I will actually serve as a sort of polar twin in that. I can respect the fact that Don likes Andy Kaufman, and I like, you know, and I understand that people find him legitimately interesting or whatever. But man, you want to talk about a guy? It's like I'm much more calm about it than I used to be. But the level to which, just like Andy Kaufman used to, just like his whole thing used to just sort of irritate and enrage me, depending on the mood I was in. Because the thing that I get from Andy Kaufman is, I get the feeling of Andy Kaufman, like when I went to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and there was it was an entire museum full of these things. But the example I always give is that there was a guy who subscribed to the Washington Times, the newspaper, and so he just did this thing of just getting the Washington Times delivered to his home, and he would, you know, not, you know, he would just take it and he would, you know, just set it in a pile. And at the end of a week, he just tied them up with some twine and brought it, and they placed it in a corner of the Museum of Modern Art, and that was a display. It was just 7 copies of the Washington Times that had been delivered to his home that he had tied up with some twine, and they set them there. And then there was this long sort of like, you know, ruminative piece on the wall, like some critic talking about it. And then, of course, if you wanted to have it in your own home, you could purchase it for the low cost of just $45,000.
Yeah.
And then I would go by, and there were these idiots standing there, striking what we all recognize as the wanky intellectual, or the person who believes himself to be intellectual, in the museum, standing there,
forefinger and thumb around chin,
yes, doing the Cameron in Ferris Bueller, looking at it. And then I swear to God, there was a guy and his girlfriend, and they were debating what it meant. And I said, what it meant is you've been horked.
Yeah,
that's what it means. It means that you've got a tiny brain, and that someone has taken your money for this.
If you could get away with it, there would be a pie in your face at that point in time. You used to be like, so what? Why did he go with lemon meringue?
I mean, it's, you know, I've always believed that there are large sections of the performance art world that are just people who are performing some sort of intellectual con. That, you know, that it's just,
yeah,
you know, it's just sort of a ruse. I think there's a finite number of performance artists, and one might even say comedians, who are doing it as some sort of meta commentary on the thing itself, or that they are trying to in some weird way hold a mirror up to society and demonstrate to people the strangeness of the audience performer interaction, or the whole notion of what is comedy and what is to stand on stage and make people laugh, and what is entertainment after all? What do we mean when we say that someone went out there and they were really funny? What does that mean and what doesn't it mean? I get all of that. I also think there are people who are just not tremendously inventive or clever, and who on some not-so-subtle level dislike the audience for which they are performing, and who loathe the people who have come there and paid money to be entertained.
Yeah.
And that they have some sort of larger, deeper problem, which they then manifest as a, in my opinion, a pretty aggressive disdain for the audience that is there watching them. And I also recognize that I am projecting a lot of my own whatever onto that, because I have a very, very, very low tolerance for people that treat their audiences badly. That is a thing that will alienate me from and turn me off of a performer faster than almost anything. If I see a performer that takes the audience's attendance for granted, or that misuses or abuses it once it's there. And the fact that there's a handful of people in the audience that, you know, it's like the... What is that statement? In Futurama, when the guy says, like the forced laughs of 1,000 art house movie patrons. I think that there's a lot of people, whether it's Andy Kaufman or whether it's anything, who feel like if they admit that they don't find something to be funny, or they don't get it, or it's just confusing, or they're going, I thought it was something else. I thought he was a guy that told jokes, that they're going to look dumb. They're going to look, they'll look like they're rubes. And so they have to put on this sheen of pseudo-intellectualism to rationalize the existence of something which, at the end of the day, isn't all that interesting. And I'm thinking specifically of him wrestling women on stage. Or he would do that thing where he would go out on stage and he would read from The Great Gatsby, you know, for like 59 minutes or something. You know, and to me, that passes the point of being self-reflexive or self-reflective or being Dada-esque or having some sort of meta-style observational comedy, because you can do that stuff. I mean, there are comics and there are performers who are gifted at using their own medium to turn the medium inside out.
Well, Steve Martin was a philosophy major in college, and that influenced, you know, the way he decided to structure his jokes.
Right.
And he was still managed to be funny.
But Steve Martin was legitimately funny. He was accessible, though.
I've always had the strong suspicion that Andy Kaufman suffered from some kind of, honest to God, mental disorder. And the fact that he was a comedian and intelligent and highly functional just sort of enabled him to kind of get away with some things that, you know, if you were a normal person, people would be like, pulling you aside and going, you really shouldn't be treating people this way or doing this stuff. I mean, and I'm saying this as someone who actually found a lot of what he did really fascinating, really funny. But I think that there's just something really pathological about a lot of his behavior.
Well, that's what I think. That's a guy who just didn't like his audience. And he felt above his audience, in my opinion. This is just my read on it. And it's a guy who sat there and had contempt for the people that made it possible for him to, you know, not ever have a real job. I feel about Andy Kaufman the way I feel about Kurt Cobain deciding at one point he wasn't going to play Smells Like Teen Spirit anymore, you know? And that way can be summed up in a two-word directive, which is F off.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's...
I won't say that I didn't find anything that Kaufman did as, you know, as marketably funny or whatever, but just who he was as a person kind of also led into that. Like, if he was a decent human being that just went out and did all these things for the sake, like you said, of holding up a mirror to society, I could sort of like, okay, well, then I get it then. But just the fact that he was a piece of S that when he got on stage personified that to an umpteenth degree under the loose guise that it was some kind of a, you know, I don't know, his own thing, or maybe he was just laughing at the audience for being stupid enough to pay money to come see somebody that talks for a living or whatever. I don't know. I don't get it. I don't have the time. And it's like I lump him in there with like Tom Green. He was funny for about 2 seconds, and then it just sort of like hit the mountain hard.
And it is possible. Don't get me wrong. It is possible to screw with the audience and to have a little bit of fun, by poking fun at the audience and by subverting their expectations or flat out just giving them something they don't want while still having an element. It sounds too flowery to say humanity, but while still respecting them enough to give them at least to screw with them in a quality fashion. The best example of that I can come up with is back in, I guess this would have been 1999. If anybody remembers the second season premiere of South Park, because they had ended everything on a huge cliffhanger of the Who's Cartman's Father. And it's hard to remember now, but there was, I mean, you know, because South Park is still huge, but that was when it was at a flashpoint of being a cultural phenomenon, and everybody in the world was talking about South Park. And they ended it on this massive, like, Who Shot JR style cliffhanger. And they said, you know, the second season finale, you know, the identity of Cartman's father will be revealed. And they just teased it, and they just promoted it relentlessly and mercilessly, where they were talking about, you know, just you don't want to miss it, because this is when the mystery will finally be solved. And then everybody tuned in for the second season premiere, And it was just a 22-minute episode of Terrence and Phillip farting.
Yeah.
Which is sort of great because they took the time to do that part of it, to do the payoff well. The payoff itself actually had content and functioned as its own standalone performance, as its own standalone art. And then, of course, they did, in fact, pay off the business of who was Cartman's, you know, dad. They actually reshuffled the schedule, I think. And, I mean, and Trey and Matt actually moved it up and made it earlier in the season than they had anticipated because they realized how pissed off people were about it and they didn't want to be dicks about it. I think you can screw with the audience and be interesting and be funny. You know, on the other hand, you can also, I don't know if you all are familiar with an album called Metal Machine Music. Anyone?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about Metal Machine Music. This is what I think of when I think of Andy Kaufman. Lou Reed, who's a guy that I like quite a lot, and Lou Reed has done some art that I really enjoy. I like a lot of Lou Reed stuff. Some of it with the Velvet Underground, a lot of it with his solo material, all the way up into albums he put out just a few years ago. Lou Reed at one point, and I think it was in 1977, put out this album called Metal Machine Music. And keep in mind, this is a real, you know, this is a real release on vinyl with the, you know, with the slipcover and the gatefold sleeve and the liner notes. And it was promoted the new album, and it's a double album. It's four sides. The new album from Lou Reed, you know, and it was a follow up to like Transformer or to Satellite of Love or whatever the album before that had been. Let me just play if I can just get a little bit of Metal Machine Music to play here. Let me drop the Miles Davis. We'll return to that in a moment because that actually makes the point. That's actually somebody covering. That is actually a band that's decided to cover Metal Machine Music. Let's see if I've actually got the actual Lou Reed cut here. Strangely enough, I don't just keep this sitting around. Let's see if I, here we go. So this is Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music. The entire double album is this. This continues for side one, which is, I don't know, about 29 minutes. Side two, side three, side four. Keep in mind, this is also in a pre-iTunes, pre-Napster era when you didn't know what the record was going to sound like.
Yeah.
You didn't know. You weren't able to sample it. And, you know, if you were a big Lou Reed fan and you didn't have time to wait for the Village Voice to tell you what a stunning work of subversive genius it was, if you didn't have time to hear Lester Bangs go, no, avoid! You would just go buy this and you would get it home and you would put it on and you would listen to this for, 2 hours. Waiting for the actual songs to begin, and he would realize that Lou Reed, without warning and without real reason, because all you'd ever done as a fan is give him your money and enable him to be a rock star for a living, had just taken your money and just given you a big pile of manure in return, and then said, thanks. And then you had to listen to 25 years of the occasional, like, Pitchfork critic telling you how this really, really was a great piece of pop art, if you just looked at it in the right way.
No, unless this album came with the amount of drugs it would take to make this sound like something entertaining, yeah, you really this is like a slap in the face.
And what's really interesting is you just heard that when I went to play Metal Machine Music, what actually happened is the first thing that came up on YouTube was some orchestra where they've just created a 2-hour recreation of Metal Machine Music, and that I think is what's almost worse is listening to people attempt to justify the existence of that thing as art or as, in Andy Kaufman's case, comedy. Now, all that having been said, I really do respect people who like Andy Kaufman because most of the people I know who identify as Andy Kaufman fans are not doing it as just some sort of intellectual put-on, and they're not just doing it to win a merit badge in hipsterism. They really do see something there that they think is interesting or original or funny. And it's not like the guy was totally without originality. He had that whole, the famous thing of taking the entire audience out for milk and cookies or whatever. He did, as much as I mentioned him reading The Great Gatsby on stage, and one of Andy Kaufman's sort of recurring bits is that he would read The Great Gatsby on stage. He would just pull out a chair and he would read it, and it was the thing with the 99 bottles of beer on the wall. He would read The Great Gatsby for like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then once he reached some point where he felt like the audience was really turning on him, he'd say, well, I could either keep reading The Great Gatsby or I could play a record. And he would take a vote of the audience, like a show of hands, and everybody would vote for the record. And then he would pull out a phonograph and he would put on a record of him reading The Great Gatsby.
From that very point.
From that point.
Yeah.
And I got to admit, there's some comedy there. I can't deny that that's funny. That's funny in the same way as Trey and Matt screwing with you by making you wait for, all summer long and then playing an episode of Terrence and Phillip farting for 22 minutes. That's funny. if that wasn't wrapped in like 45 minutes of contemptuous dismissal, I think I'd find it a lot funnier.
Yeah.
I think that I just don't I can't wade through the Lucky Charms Brown stuff to get to the occasional marshmallow like that with Andy Kaufman. I just can't. I think that he was a guy who had flashes of inspiration, and I would say even flashes of true creative genius, but they were just swaddled in this not at all hidden loathing for the audience that I just cannot tolerate. That's kind of my thing with him.
I agree 100%.
But you're a comic. You live and work in that world. So I mean, what do comics think of him?
Well, it's very much varied. You know, you won't get two people next to each other that really kind of follow it. Luckily, we're moving into far enough away from when that sort of whole thing kind of hit that only occasionally will you get someone that will reference him. You don't get anyone nowadays really trying to go back and do what it was that he did,
right?
Because that, I think, is proof that it really was the majority of the people that say, oh, I get it, and it was a genius, are the ones that are terrified that if they would go against it, it would be labeled as idiots, morons. I don't really care what label you throw on me. I know crap when I smell it. And this, there really is just nothing really redeemable as a whole for the whole thing. The whole Latka, you know, immigrant voice guy thing. It's got its moments, but like I said, you can't sort of build an entire empire on that, and not nearly as high as the pedestal on which he is placed by most people that say that you know they kind of get him.
And let's be honest, he also has the dead at 35 thing working for him too.
Yeah, supposedly dead.
Yes. The thing about Andy Kaufman, I think the only way in which Andy Kaufman really works is if you just make the distinction in your head that you're not going to view him as a comedian.
Yeah.
If you are not going to view him even really as an entertainer. If you try to view him as an entertainer or a comedian, that's where it all falls down. I think if you create some separate category in your head, and not even that category would be called, and just stick him there, I think maybe you can view it as, and I don't even think he intended this, but I think you can almost view Andy Kaufman as a mechanism by which you can analyze not comedy, but I think the way that people over the years have responded to his material and his act, I think serves as a mechanism by which you can examine the behavior of audiences and how they respond to different kinds of comedy depending on who they're with, what critics think about it, what society thinks about it, what else is going on in comedy at the time. You know, I think it's a very... I think there's laboratory settings where they try to understand things like benevolence or malevolence by having people do these experiments where, you know, do you pass a homeless guy in the street and give him $5, or do you view a woman as pretty or ugly depending on whether or not you're being told that she fires people for a living, and it's how you the prism through which you view things. I think Andy Kaufman, his work, I think, exists as a sort of mechanism by which you can view the criteria that people use to judge things. But having said all that, I don't think he intended any of that. I think that's all just stuff that springs up around anybody, anybody that makes a cultural impact.
It's something that we can't put an immediate label on, so we'll sort of smother in a bunch of other flashy pop phrases or terms that kind of give you the leeway into sort of a vague understanding, when in fact that the joke was just on you all along. If you want to go with it, fine. If you want to call it, you know, bunk, then do that as well. But don't sit there and create this entire sub-universe of genius around something that...
I feel about Andy Kaufman the way I feel about a lot of, like, Andy Warhol art. Mm-hmm. And the way I feel when I watch certain David Lynch films, where I just think, he is somewhere in Santa Barbara just laughing at me, and laughing at the studio that paid him to do this.
Yeah.
And hey, I guess if you can get work doing that, more power to you. But let's not pretend, let's not you and I confuse it with actual art. So, you know, that's, but again, just, you know, it is, it, and that's why I said I hesitate to even bring it up. Because it's like, you know, it is, and I really am not trying to start anything else. And I'm just saying this because it's the first thing that comes to mind. But it's sort of like it's like bringing up Bill Hicks, where it's like you bring up Bill Hicks in a room, and I know people who will just say Mike Chase, actually, of Mike and Amy, said, you know, that Bill Hicks left a good looking intellectual corpse, and he said that, you know, if you were to examine Bill Hicks without the filter of dead from cancer far too young, you know, about 50% of what people think he did that was genius would sort of dissipate. I'm not saying that I believe that because I'm not even want to wade into the Bill Hicks debate. But that is, but and Mike's not a dumb guy. Mike's a funny guy in his own right, and I would say, and he has very well thought out legitimate opinions on popular culture, but he feels that Bill Hicks is vastly overrated. I happened to be in a room when he made that observation at one point. He goes, well, you know, he's like, Bill Hicks was kind of funny, but he sort of left a good-looking intellectual corpse, you know, the same way that Kurt Cobain did. You know, wrote some nice songs, died young, thus genius was sort of his take on it. And I happened to be in the room when he said that with somebody who was a big Bill Hicks fan. And it's like, I thought it was like muskets were going to be produced. I mean, I really thought they were going to end up just pummeling each other in the hallway because there's just certain things that are just never, you know, you're never going to bring the house together on them. And I think Andy Kaufman is the same way.
Yeah.
Don Taylor, final thoughts?
Not really. I can't say that I was like a complete fan, but hell, you know, I like David Lynch movies too. So what do I know?
There's bad, and then there's good. There's good bad. There's you know, stuff that you love to, like a guilty pleasure that you like to indulge in on occasion, even though you know that there's really no payoff, no real substance to it. But like you said, the payoff has to be there in some capacity. Otherwise, you're the one paying $44,000 for a stack of newspapers that, you know, retails for about $5.
Somebody does say, and yet I am paying you money so you can have a guy named Big Jim come in the air and call me an idiot for liking Andy Kaufman. Who hates the audience now? And the other comment is that we're still discussing Andy Kaufman after all these years later. He says it may not be comedy, but it was definitely art in some way. So, you know, again, you know, if you can get work being Andy Kaufman, hey, you know, have at it. It ain't for me, but not everything has to be for me. So there you go. Another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. What is up in your life, sir? You're going to be what are you doing these days?
I got a couple of bookings this month. They're coming up this month. I'll be in part of the showcase at the Beauty Bar on April 14th. It's at 111 Southwest Ass Street. So if you want, it's you know, free. Just come on down. I need at least two people to show up and say that they were there on my behalf.
Can I get like a mani pedi or something while I'm watching?
Sure, I'll bring an emery board, girl. I do some work.
Isn't that what happens at the beauty bar? You can actually get like something done while you're having a beverage.
Well,
I might think you have something else.
It is near the Shanghai tunnels, so I mean.
You can find out more about Big Jim Willig online at BigJimWillig.com. It is BigJimWillig, BigJimWillig.com. Excellent. All right. Well, it is 3:40, so we will be bringing the curtain down here on this program in just a moment. You can find this program online. Don't forget, if you are not subscribing to this show in iTunes, you're a fool. So you can do that.
We still have so much left to say.
It's so hot in here.
We haven't been talking enough this week.
Can I just say this, by the way, that I have to double check and see if I've heard back from the guy. No, and I haven't. I'll have to wait because I want to get his permission before I read it. We got the best email, and I don't mean to tease, but I emailed the guy back and I said, can I tell this on the air? Can I read this email on the air? And he hasn't responded back yet because he mentions a few, he refers to one of his neighbors. He uses a pseudonym, but he refers to the way he and his neighbor belong to the same organization, so it could be sussed out who the guy is. So I want to make sure that I get his permission. We have the best email, though, about our appearance on KPAM earlier this week, so I'll get to that. I did get an email from somebody earlier this week. We were talking about how we were just exhausted and just drained and giddy by the end of Wednesday. We had our listener, our good friend Todd the Corpse, who actually said that he had developed a little bit of a crush on Dom when you were just giggling and saying vagina over and over again.
Yes.
And then we had Tony, who said, about your heavy work week, let me get this straight. You're shutting it down early yesterday because you had to work three straight 7-hour days. And I'm paying you. Jesus, I guess I should have gotten a GED as well. So there you go. So that's,
well, to
that's
be
why
fair,
I try not to complain, because then, you know, I'm
it's,
a dick.
It's 7 straight hours of talk sitting in a chair. Without any, you know, machinery around you. There's a laptop. There's at least 3 laptops present.
I know, I know that standing on stage and doing comedy is draining too. It is. It's hard. It's exhausting.
Very much so, yeah.
But you and I both know that as much as that's true, we both know that it no matter how true it is, it just makes you sound like a huge dick when you complain about it. I mean, there's no getting it. Those two things are both true. I mean, something can be true and yet also a thing that you just have to just keep to yourself.
That's why most of us, you know, most entertainers tend to turn to opiates such as cocaine to keep them going for
exactly.
those long, long hours. They don't look like they're complaining about standing on stage and, you know, chatting. Oh, I worked for an hour and 45 minutes yesterday and they paid me over $3,000 to do it.
I'm so wiped out.
Yeah.
We made this observation before that it's like complaining about a paper cut. Everybody knows the paper cuts really hurt. They hurt like a bastard. But at the same time, if you complain about a paper cut, you look like a big pussy. There's just no way around it. There's just so, you know, so in any event. So thanks to everybody just as we wrap this week up for listening and to tolerating our just flat out insanity at some points during the past 5 days. Thanks to everybody who listened to us over on the KPM. That was an interesting couple of days. So that when we filled in the Bob Miller Show, thank you. And thanks again to KPM for inviting us in for the fill-in.
Special thanks to Todd the Corpse.
That's right. And thanks to Big Jim Willick for joining us today. FunEmploymentRadio.com. New episode posted here probably in about 25 minutes because they're going to be doing a sport Landia over at trailblazers.tv in about 19 minutes. It's 4 p.m. Pacific time. You can catch Greg Nibbler and Sarah X Dillon doing a new episode of Sportlandia at trailblazers.tv. Big Jim Willig can be found at bigjimwillig.com online. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of the day's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milkpacking district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Sagler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Join us on next week when our guests will include Ryan White, Aaron Mesh, and his parents in studio, and Mr. Eric D. Snyder. As always, we thank you for listening. It is Friday, April 1st, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. Have a safe and satisfying weekend. Thank you for listening. See you Monday. Bye now.